Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program this morning Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She's a dermatologist. She has a practice here in our area, and we have asked her to be with us before to do a basic kind of show about skin and skin care. As it is winter, I'm sure that we will talk about dealing with winter dry skin. But if folks who are listening have other kinds of questions, that's really why we're doing the program, to give you an opportunity to call in. Now, of course, we always try to remind people when we do programs like this with physicians that we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone. There are limits to what we can do because the doctor can't see you, but this is a place to start. You can ask some basic questions. We hope that these programs will add to your health knowledge, and then if you have a real concern, then obviously you have to go on and pursue that with someone who can see you. But this is a place to start, and I certainly don't want to discourage anyone from calling, and I know the doctor will do her best to answer people's questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have that toll-free line, and it's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I was looking back, and I kind of think that you maybe of the several dermatologists that we have had on the program, I kind of think that you've been here more often in the winter time than anybody else.
I think that's I'm true. Kind of your winter dermatologist.
The winter dermatologist. So maybe we'll talk a little bit first to start about that, and then we have some callers, and we'll take some questions. Winter is hard on skin. The air is dry. Particularly in people's homes, the air is dry. And if you're exposed to the cold outside, it's kind of harsh. And so, yeah, in wintertime, people have a lot of complaints about dry skin, itching, peeling, cracking. I got some, my knuckles are not looking real good here this morning. So give us the basics on taking care of your skin in the wintertime.
The basics are that we want to have as little extra drying, besides these environmental things that you were talking about, as we can. And so a lot of people do a lot more soap use on the backs of their hands than they actually have to. So one thing to keep in mind is where your hands are dirty, it's a good place to wash them with a little bit of soap. Not always antibacterial, sometimes antibacterial, but to confine it mostly to the palmar surfaces instead of on the backs of the hands. And then there are wonderful barrier creams and lotions to use on hands. It seems to me that maybe either my patients know me well by now, or I've been handing out gentle skincare information long enough that I'm not having as many issues. It's also been a warmer winter, I guess. But main things to avoid are really hot showers, bubble bath in really hot baths, and the use of soap, especially more drying soaps with a lot of antibacterial, or especially with those little gritties in them. Don't want to use that kind of soap on your skin. And to confine the use of soap to those areas where you really need it, like the armpits and private areas and feet. And maybe only use soap on your whole body every week or two. And not to use a loofah, not to use a wash rag. And to pat dry and then apply one of the very many nice moisturizers. If people are really itchy, they probably shouldn't use one with a lot of fragrance in it.
Mm-hmm. And it is possible for people, in addition to all the variety of moisturizers and skincare stuff that people can buy over the counter, that you can also buy some over the counter products that have a little bit of cortisone
exactly.
in them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
That helps tremendously in your knuckle situation.
Yeah.
If you use that, especially if you get an ointment base of the 1% over the counter hydrocortisone, it can help tremendously. And then there are little white cotton gloves that you can get that are medication gloves. They're not like for dusting, but and you can put those on over that cortisone and a good Vaseline-based barrier cream, and you can do tremendous improvement with dry skin.
Yeah, now if you put those two things together, dusting and gloves and moisturizing gloves, you'd have a product there.
Right.
We have a couple of calls here to talk with. Let's do that. We'll start out with someone who is listening in Indiana this morning on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. I'd like for you to speak generally about skin tags. In particular, which part of the skin do they grow from? And secondly, I'm not concerned about the cosmetic aspect of it, but what does one look at to see if something is going wrong, in particular, I guess? And I just wondered if have they ever come even close to what the hell causes them, so to speak. But I was particularly interested in what level of the skin that they grow from. They certainly look different from anything else, you know. And I remember when I first saw them, I was a youngster, and, you know, I thought, God, that guy's sick really bad, you know. It was in a shower area, you know, swimming and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I got some sort of bad vibes already on that. Then later on, I started getting them. I got concerned, and the doctor said, you know, not that serious, you know, blah, 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 and told me a number of things. But I was interested in those questions. Thanks a lot.
Okay, sure. skin tags are kind of bad luck, I guess, is where we would put them in. They are quite hereditary, and they seem to come in areas of rubbing. So most people will see them around their neck, around their armpits, and in women in the inframammary area. So skin tags come from the very most superficial layers of the skin. And sometimes they're just little 1 millimeter ditzels. But some people can grow some really huge looking skin tags that can be like the size of a pencil eraser. And those aren't necessarily tags. Those can be moles. They can be things called neurofibromas, which are actually signs of another condition. So if somebody has multiple large fleshy papules that you can like push on, and they are kind of gelatinous and they sort of indent, those aren't really tags. Those are maybe neurofibromas, and those are maybe a sign of something else going on, which is actually a genetic condition. So they usually come sometimes from teenage years on. So if you have 100 great big flappy eraser sized things in your armpits, you may not just have skin tags. But for most people, they are just small epidermal protrusions. That means from the very top layer of the skin. And you only want to worry about them. Actually, you never need to worry about them. If they turn black, it's typically because they've twisted on their little stalk, because usually they have a skinny stalk and a bigger hangy portion. And if they twist on their little stalk, they turn black, they get irritated, and they fall off. And that's just because they've killed off their own blood supply in the twisting. So actual skin tags, you really never need to worry about. Mm. There was a time that they were equating people with multiple huge numbers of rapid onset skin tags with the possibility that they were also growing colon polyps. And, you know, was there some association there? So they kind of poo-pooed that study later on, saying, well, in fact, they were only studying people who already had colon polyps and they happened to have a lot of tags. So there may be something about some people who grow a lot of extra epidermal skin portions that they should probably get their colonoscopies like everybody else and have them biopsied.
So, and if these things, if they really can, so it sounds as if you're saying that basically this is a cosmetic issue, not something you really need to worry about, but I suppose if you have these things and it really bothers you, you could have them removed. It shouldn't be a big deal.
Right. It is easy to have them removed. And in fact, sometimes when people just have a few and they very clearly have a skinny little neck and a bigger portion sticking off, which implies that they're absolutely benign skin tags. I even tell people sometimes to make a little tiny noose out of dental floss and push the noose way down toward the skin, and if they can stand it, have somebody tighten it real tight. And then they'll kill themselves off that way. But we remove them all the time. And in fact, from a cosmetic point of view, it's an extremely delightful experience to have your skin tags removed, because you feel a lot younger when you get them off.
Yeah, all right. Other questions here. Back here locally, and the next person in line is in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's me?
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to know if there was anything new about alopecia, the universalis form of it. Is there anything new about trying to undo the process?
Well, I made a sad face when you called, because I was just at a conference, and the main, I'll refer to her as the queen of alopecia, got up and she said, I'm sorry to say that I have absolutely nothing new to report.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't know. None of the immunomodulator medicines, which have worked very well in some other kinds of autoimmune conditions, seem to do very much for alopecia universalis or even areata. So we're still back to our same old, and one thing for the universalis is just in the wintertime to be really careful not to inhale too much really cold air, since there are no hairs inside the nostrils to protect that mucous membrane, and to maybe even wear a mask, you know, and when you're outside breathing. But it's a tough one. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to line number two. This is someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I've always had problems, and my family has problems with chapping and chafing with the fingers, so I've got that handled. My issue is dryness of the elbows and knees. I have tried the normal hand creams and all that other stuff, and my elbows and knees get so dry sometimes that it's like sandpaper, and it's actually sharp and painful if you touch it. So if you can give me any advice, any guidelines, I'd love that, and I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
This is a kind of a common problem, and in fact, we have the pleasant name for it of housemaid's elbows and knees. And sometimes they do even get these little spicules. And it's probably some kind of an abnormal turnover of the surface layers of the skin, making this really significant buildup. So lotions don't do that much for it. Some of the things that can be helpful, though, some people use ester gel, which is a tar-based substance, which is over-the-counter, and you can apply that for a little bit or just maybe even wash with it. And then there are substances, one of them that's called Carasil, which is an over-the-counter salicylic acid ointment, which is typically in the foot section of like the Dr. Scholl's area. And the salicylic acids can really help normalize through time that thick kind of skin. Applying some of that same cortisone that we were talking about earlier with the Carasil or another time of the day can also be helpful. And actually putting a little saran wrap over whatever gamish of ointments you make on these areas can also help with the penetration. But it is usually a wintertime recurrent problem. And there is no magic, but this stuff all really does help maintain well.
Okay, we have some other callers here. Our guest, let me just introduce again, is Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She is a dermatologist. She has a practice here in our area, and occasionally she is here on the program. We talk about skin care, and whatever questions you have, I know she will do her best to try and help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next person is on a cell phone on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. The other evening on Discovery Channel or Health Channel on the dish, they had a lady that weighed approximately 100 pounds, and she had a 200-pound abnormal growth, and it was an external tumor, and it was on her stomach and her abdominal area and around to her back. They removed the 200-pound tumor, and then they waited for a couple of days and grafted cadaver skin on the person. My question is, why did they not some of her own skin to graft back on her body? You know, I assume they could process it or, you know, put it in some type of solution to keep it healthy until that point of time.
Well, I would imagine that a 200-pound tumor would have actually a huge amount of
adipose tissue, yes.
Of area, but of area that was involved. And sometimes with these tumors, it may have been that it was impossible to sort of fillet the tumor off the back of the skin that was removed with the tumor adequately to make sure that it wasn't going to regrow, depending on, you know, which layers. Because sometimes if it is a tumor that is of epidermal origin, perhaps they were concerned that the actual skin that was on top of the tumor, which you would think logically they would use instead of a cadaver graft, I understand what you're saying, maybe they were afraid that it was going to reproduce the tumor in some way.
Okay, well, I know the cadaver tissue, took on the person.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like, 2 years later, she had another abnormal growth. But I think it was, they were just watching it. But I was just curious, why they did not say that. I didn't know, the reason why.
Well, I'm not 100% sure, but that would be my guess.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you. Let's go to line number one. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I have a family member who lives in a dry part of the country and who is a high-tech biologist kind of person, so she tends to know what she's talking about. And she doesn't like to use skin creams that have a petroleum base. She said there's some kind of feedback loop that goes on that with our skin that reduces, actually causes our skin to reduce the amount of oil we put out. I may not be saying this quite right. Does this make any sense to you?
A petroleum-based product.
So, for instance, she uses Cetaphil as a skin cream?
Mm-hmm. As opposed to something more like a Vaseline base.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I don't think your skin is maybe smart enough to figure out if you were using a Vaseline base, that it wouldn't. A lot of people don't like the way they feel because they actually make a little bit more of a coating. And if they're high-techy kind of people, especially, they might not want to touch their, their high-techy kind of equipment when their hands are greasy. I don't know that there is some biological feedback loop that makes your skin less healthy by using something. We use it all the time and usually find in the situations where we use it that it helps. Sorry.
Well, I hadn't heard anything about this anywhere, so I thought I'd ask another expert. Thanks a bunch.
All right.
Take care.
We'll go here to someone on a cell phone. We're calling from Ron Gibson City. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah. I have kind of an odd occurrence that happened to me over Christmas time, and just wanted to ask your guest there. Came across a rash, started on the lower part of my chest and kind of was working its way across, the middle. It was initially itchy, scratchy, and then it would stop, but it did form kind of a red callus. Went in to see my doctor, and, he said it was ringworm. And my wife was treating it with tenactin, and anyway, it's kind of dissipated, and it's gone away and hasn't really been an issue. We kind of did a little detective work, and she had bought me three brand-new dress shirts, which I wore right out of the box, heavily starched. And then that is when we noticed, and I've never been affected by any sort of skin lesions or anything like that, and that's when we noticed that this happened. And once I stopped wearing his shirts and she washed them, it hasn't reoccurred. And I was just wondering, are we completely crazy here? Is there any connection? And exactly what is ringworm and how common is it?
Okay, a good series of questions. First, I hope you learned the lesson that whenever you get a brand new thing for Christmas, you should wash it before you put it on, because that is a really common thing. I mean, sometimes we have people who go in and they try on a whole bunch of clothes and they come home with a rash, and it's not that they caught ringworm from somebody else who tried on the shirt before they did. It's because that the chemicals they use to make things look nice and starchy are really extremely irritating to your skin, particularly in the abdomen area. If you had, for instance, tucked in one of these fancy new shirts and then put firewood in the fireplace and sweated just a little bit, you can leach out really nasty chemicals from an unwashed shirt and start a reaction. So if it was in an area in your abdomen where your belt was rubbing and your shirt was new and you sweated a little bit, you can actually end up with quite a significant dermatitis. Ringworm diagnosed is probably the most common misdiagnosis I see, because all eczema, which is an inflammation of the skin, looks like a circle, usually, and even often if it's caused just by an irritant. So what I usually find is that it's diagnosed as ringworm. You start putting creams on it, and it's not the anti-ringworm stuff in the cream that helps. It's the cream itself that helps and the fact that you wash the shirt. So no, you're not crazy. Wash stuff before you put it on. And next time, if you have a little reaction like that, pick up some Cordaid, and it probably will work a little bit faster. And another thing that often, when you say it kind of formed a callus, oftentimes these things are pretty itchy and people scratch them enough that they actually develop almost a little crusting on them, that your body's trying to protect itself from the scratching and it thickens up pretty significantly. So I have seen people make some really nasty dermatitis. And one thing I'm just going to bring up here, if nobody else does, is that oftentimes, if you get one of these itchy, scratchy places, and they happen often on ankles or on abdomens or on lower backs, that keeps on growing and, in fact, gets, you know, what we refer to as a honey-colored crust or some crusting and oozing on the surface, we're seeing a lot of really nasty bacterial infections of the skin that we didn't used to see. And that's not what you had, because clearly yours went away. But if you get something that is not going away, it's probably a good idea when you get to your healthcare person to actually suggest, because they might not think of it, to culture the substance, whatever little kind of juiciness there is to it, because we are seeing a lot of this methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus in cultures much more than we used to see just in the last couple of years.
Do you think, just an aside, and I'll hang up, do you think it has anything to do with, this might be a stretch, but the world economy and so much of the clothes and whatnot are processed overseas, and these things are kind of locked in the fabric and...
If you're talking about, was there fungus locked in your fabric? No, I don't think there was fungus locked in your fabric. I think that it was just the other things they used to make it look nice. So, no, I mean, there's a lot of trouble with the world economy, but I don't think fungus in your clothes is one of them.
So is there some explanation for why it is that you're starting to see more of these skin bacterial infections that you mentioned?
Well, the antibiotic resistance issues, I think... You know, Americans typically feel like they need to walk out of a doctor's office with an antibiotic prescription, even if everybody's pretty sure that it's really viral. And if it's a viral condition or a viral sore throat or a viral, you know, lung problem, the antibiotic isn't going to do any good, but we give it just in case. So the drug companies have managed to make some really big guns that are one-time-a-day antibiotic, but they cover a huge, broad range of bacteria. And so it's really simple to give somebody a prescription for a one-time-a-day prescription, you know, one-time-a-day antibiotic that they're going to take for 10 days in case they have something bacterial. And I'm not saying that other doctors do this, because, you know, we do a lot of it in dermatology with acne and are just really doing our darndest to try to figure out ways to use less antibiotics in the treatment of our conditions, because this is going to be a huge problem. It's already in sports. It's a huge problem.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I was thinking about asking about, antibiotics and acne. And just, I guess I was thinking about it because recently we had something on, it was something that was on NPR about that very thing. One of the things apparently they have found out is that it's possible to get the therapeutic effect with quite a low dose, so that you can back off the dose, but that's still, I think one still comes back to the question, should you be giving it for that at all, and are you creating a problem? Because there are some people apparently who have taken antibiotics for that reason for years.
Yes. We are actually, I'm just trying right now my very first patients on what's called a sub-therapeutic, a non-antimicrobial dosage of an antibiotic. Mm-hmm. Doxycycline is one that we use. It's in the tetracycline family. We use it commonly in acne. And there is some research that implies that a very low dose, 20 milligrams twice a day, as opposed to the usual 100 milligrams a day that we give, does not make the antimicrobial resistance problem worse, but that may help the acne. The problem with this drug in the past, when we heard about this in the last couple of years, it was something that's called Periostat, this drug, and it's a very low dose of doxycycline, but it was extremely expensive, like, you know, a dollar a pill or something. And so it was, and it wasn't covered under any plans. So I'm actually, you know, in my practice trying to figure out some different kinds of treatment, maybe some more mechanical treatment using some lights and lasers, which we hope is maybe going to be helpful for acne, and trying to get it paid for by insurance rather than all the antibiotics, because at this point, you know, they only pay for generic drugs. And we've had extremely good luck with the antibiotics we use. And in fact, the cyclines are not typical Staph aureus drugs. I mean, they don't even have a big... So I don't think that the Staph aureus part of the problem is as much acne-related as it is maybe the more generalized broad-spectrum antibiotics. But it's all a problem. It's a huge problem. And so we're trying to work every way we can. And but we do really need them in some of our people. Yeah. And there is... Propionibacterium acnes is one of the causative organisms in bad acne, and we have to treat that with antibiotics.
Let me ask you one other acne-related question, and then I'll get back to people on the phone here. Recently, again, there have been some concerns raised about the drug Accutane, which is a prescription medicine for acne. And the big worry about Accutane is that if you take it and you're pregnant, it can cause really serious birth defects. So all along here, I think the big thing was for women who are taking this medication, you want to make sure absolutely you do everything you possibly can to make sure that you do not get pregnant. Still, that seems to be a big concern. And I don't know if that's even leading some people to ask the question, should it be used at all? Should we be doing something even more in terms of education and making sure that women don't get pregnant while they're taking the medicine? Is there anything new on this?
Well, you may have seen a sad look on my face on this one, too. This is, we have been working extremely hard as a dermatologic community to prevent women from getting pregnant when they're on Accutane. And we've had all kinds of programs in place of people signing things, of only being able to get a prescription for 1 month, of having a pregnancy test every month. And somehow, although I don't know how this happens, it certainly doesn't happen in my practice, but it's happening somewhere, that about 120 people 10 years ago got pregnant during the course of Accutane. We put in all of these restrictions on the use and, signed forms and free pregnancy tests and counseling for pregnancy, all this stuff. And still about 120 people got pregnant, So now starting March 1st, there is a program which is so difficult and restrictive that, everybody in my office is like, oh, my gosh, how are we going to do this? It's called the iPledge program. We are all signed up as individual practitioners, in the office, on a computer. We have to be registered. The patient of childbearing age has to be registered every month. The pharmacist has to be registered. The wholesaler has to be registered. Have to have pregnancy tests every month. There are huge amounts of restrictions, papers to sign. The fact is that Accutane is an amazing and wonderful drug for bad acne. And it is a six-month course as opposed to antibiotics, which are often a 5 or 6 year course. I will do whatever I can to keep access to my patients for Accutane because it is such a helpful drug for them. I don't believe, we monitor it very carefully. Very rarely do I have to stop Accutane for any reason of lab abnormalities or problems for the patient. So, yeah, it's the iPledge program is going to be a real issue. And we're doing the best we can with it. And we're having a staff meeting next Wednesday morning at this very time, trying to make sure that we have all of our ducks in a row and eggs in the basket.
All right. Well, we have some other people here who have questions, and we'll be taking as many as we can. And we're about midway through here. Our guest is Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She is a dermatologist. She has practice here in our area in Urbana. And she's here to talk about skin, and we'll do her best to answer questions about her area of practice. 333-945-5 here in Champaign-Urbana. That's the number to call. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about, actually, I want to just ask a real quick question about the Accutane. You said that was a six-month process. So does that mean that if you take that for 6 months, you never get acne again?
In about 70% to 75% of cases, that is the fact. That that your acne treatment, except for, sometimes for topical treatments, is pretty much done. Now, the issue is, from a young person point of view, if somebody has terrible cystic acne, girl acne statistically peaks at about 17 and boy acne at about 19. So if you treat a boy with terrible cystic acne when he's 16, his hormones very likely are going to, kick in and cause another, flare of potentially bad acne, but nowhere near as bad as it would have been later on. So there are a fair number of people, especially in that 30%, that don't get, the complete forever kind of help with acne that we hope they're going to get, who go through a second course, sometimes even a third course as time goes on. But, if my child had really bad acne, there's no question in my mind that I would go through a course of Accutane intermittently sort of almost rather than being on antibiotics forever, if I could swing it. It's extremely expensive also, the medicine, and so.
So you have to take the Accutane once a day?
It's off. It depends on – it's dosed by weight. So most people have to take it twice a day, morning and evening.
Okay. My question, the reason I called is my husband has very dry hands, and his hands crack every winter pretty badly. And he's used Vaseline, and that's not enough. And I was wondering – you were mentioning something that had tar in it, and I was wondering what would be the best treatment for cracked hands.
It's really a really tough one because of some people's jobs just have them out, you know, cold and dry and cracked. Is it fingertips or kind of more around knuckles?
Knuckles.
Okay, the knuckles are actually a little bit easier to work on, and so I would say that. You know, that Estar gel is something that's over-the-counter and a little bit of tar.
E-S-T-A-R?
Yes, that's something that you can use a little bit of. And you have to be careful, though. It may be something that you'd only want to leave on for a brief period of time. Cordate on the knuckles, the white cotton gloves that I was talking about earlier are really extremely helpful. And sometimes when people get deep fissures on their knuckles, there actually is a low level of infection in those cracks, and they just can't heal up very well. So if it is really persistent and they're really deep and painful, you may want to go to your doctor again and get a culture, because this is another place where sometimes antibiotics is the only thing we can use to get somebody over the healing phase. Other things that can be really helpful on those deep fissures are liquid Band-Aid, which you can paint on several layers, and it liquid Band-Aid.
Liquid Band-Aid.
Or Second Skin. Some of them are in sprays. They come in little tubes that that has a little applicator, a little rubber applicator, and you put a little dot on it and then put multiple layers of the liquid Band-Aid over that fissure so it makes like a little cast, and that can make it feel much better. And that's Caracel, which I mentioned earlier, the salicylic acid ointment.
How do you spell that?
K-E-R-A-S-A-L, Caracel.
Okay.
And that's over-the-counter, too. So that set of things, you know, may help a lot. If it's a really deep fissure and you put salicylic acid on it, it can really sting. Possibly some polysporin could be helpful if there is a little low-level infection.
Okay.
Mixed in the things. So I would just have a whole series of things that he can use and apply. And, he don't want him to use a brush and lava soap and all that kind of stuff when he's washing his hands. He should just be as gentle as he can. There's another one, the Neutrogena Norwegian Formula hand cream is also a very, good healing one to have him put on at night.
You were mentioning the cotton gloves. Mm-hmm. You would put the medication on and then put the cotton gloves on?
Exactly. And you don't need to wash them every time you use them. You want to maybe wash them every week or so. And even if he says, I'm not going to sleep in cotton gloves, he might be willing to watch TV for an hour in cotton gloves, in an evening, with the ointment on. And then just rub it all in. You don't need to wash off one to put the other ones on. You can kind of layer them. What I told you about the liquid Band-Aid is a little dicey, in that your skin has to be kind of dry around the edges for that to stick. So
right.
you have to kind of play it by ear. You might want to practice on, one or two fissures with the liquid Band-Aid, see if that heals well from the inside, and goop up the other ones.
Okay.
Good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much I rinse, I can't get the soap off when I take a shower. You have any suggestions?
I shouldn't say this, but I don't know that maybe you're right. You have like a shower with water that comes out of it at a fairly brisk pace?
Yeah.
What kind of soap are you using?
I've tried them all. And the same is true of shampoo. It just won't come off.
I have never heard this problem before.
Is that so?
Yeah. So I think, you know, it may be that you have, this sounds a little silly, but maybe you could ask somebody else to feel your skin when you thought you weren't well rinsed.
Uh-huh.
I mean, has this been a lifelong thing that you feel like you get out and you're not rinsed?
I'm 81 years old, and I would say it's fairly recent. Maybe 5 or 6 years.
Huh.
I was hoping that...
Do you feel, like, oily all the time and the rest of your skin in general?
No. I mean, after I dry myself, I forget about it, but I give up. That's it. In the shower, I rinse and rinse and rinse, and there's still
you're not applying
of soap.
You're not applying a lot of emollients after you get out of the shower, are you, or creams?
No.
Okay.
I don't at all.
You know, I'd almost wonder if there isn't, you know, a little bit of a change, maybe even in your nerves as how you're perceiving it, because this does not, I mean, I'm not saying that it's not a problem, but I think that it may be more of a sensational issue rather than anything you really need to worry about.
Yeah.
And I would be concerned about you first overwashing and then over rinsing, you know, at 81. So why don't you try, get a plain Cetaphil bar, Cetaphil, and not the one for just, it's a sensitive skin bar, and just try that because it doesn't really have any emollient in it, and I wouldn't use any of the body scrubs that have moisturizers in them, and I wouldn't use Dial, and I wouldn't use Safeguard. Try a plain Cetaphil bar, and just wash in those places I was talking about before, back of your neck, your face, your groin, your feet, and just rinse and see if maybe that helps. I mean, don't use soap on the rest of you unless you've been out in the garden or something.
Okay, would you spell that, please, or just repeat it?
Cetaphil, Cetaphil bar.
I see.
Okay.
That's in pharmacies?
It's just over the counter. Yeah, it's at pharmacies and drugstores. There's a huge amount of these Cetaphil products, so don't get confused. It's just the plain Cetaphil bar.
Okay.
And good luck. And not to worry about this. If you have no itching and stuff afterwards, I think you probably are really rinsed, even if you don't feel it.
Okay.
I would worry about something else.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She is a dermatologist. We're talking about skin care, and if you have questions, she'll do her best to help you out. 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free. 800-222-9455, and we just keep going. Line number two is next, and this is someone in Urbana.
First of all, this is not why I called, but I would just like to say that perhaps the last gentleman asked Dr. Jacobson about something that was actually outside of her area of expertise. What he's describing sounds to me an awful lot like his water is simply too soft.
I actually thought about that myself.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Good point.
And if,
it does
what
feel
I would
slimy.
Have asked him was whether or not he lived in the country and has a home water softener or whether he lives in the town. And if he lives in the country and has a home water softener, I would suggest that he at least do a test by not regenerating the water softener. That is to say, let the water get hard and see if he still has that problem. And if he does, maybe he needs to, readjust the water softener in some way so that it doesn't soften the water quite as much. It's always good to have just a little hardness in the water.
Right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, I remember when I went to college, I thought that I could never get rinsed because they had a lot softer water.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now,
good
whether
point.
Or not
I hope he's still listening.
Yeah, right. But whether or not that sensation actually can cause a dermatological problem is in your area of expertise. And I have the feeling that what you said toward the end would suggest that it really probably is not going to cause a problem. But I don't know. Maybe that's outside of my area of expertise.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for your good point.
Okay. At any rate, to what I was going to talk about, I have for years, or I should say had for years, this problem of cracked and drying skin in the wintertime, the same thing that other people describe. These little places open up that I would have to put super glue on, and I tried all mode and manner of creams, and including the spray-on new skin that you talked about, liquid Band-Aid, Neutrogena, nothing seemed to work, although I have to admit that I did not have the discipline to apply this stuff 15 times a day. I would only put it on at night once, and that was the only time I would ever use it. Then about 2 years ago, I got a dog, and ever since then, I have not had the problem. And all I can figure is that the lanolin in the fur of the dog being applied several times a day, as I pet the dog several times a day, has made the problem pretty much go away, although I still have it underneath my fingernails from time to time.
Hmm.
So I would suggest, as this is anecdotal evidence, you can tell me if there have been any studies on this, but perhaps if people have tried everything and nothing else works, get a dog and pet the dog.
Well, I'd go entirely along with you from a point of view of being a dog lover. did anything else change, like you retired or something?
No, nothing else.
And nothing.
That's a good thought, though.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, I'll have to say that eczema has its own mind, and
yeah.
It sounds like, you know, that's what you've had. And so I won't refute what you say. I don't.
Yeah.
No, it is a little anecdotal, but sometimes it does just go away, too.
I
have patients who we do absolutely everything for, and then we stop doing everything, and it goes away. So.
Yeah, I was thinking that it may be the lanolin in the dog's fur.
Sure. It could be. Some people, lanolin's good stuff. And
this particular dog has rather shiny fur.
Mm-hmm.
You
pet that dog, and I'm glad you're feeling better.
Okay. All right. Just the thought I should... share with other people in case they've tried everything and nothing works, which is what happened to me.
Oh, great.
Well,
right. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Well, we'll go on here. Line number three. This is someone on the campus. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Good morning to both of you.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit embarrassed, I guess. But for the last 10 years, I've been dealing with some kind of an abrasion that happens on my scalp, on my underneath my hair. I build up a scab, areas of my scalp that have kind of a scabby texture. And I went to a dermatologist, about 7 or 8 years ago, and he looked at it and had a name for it. And he said to use T-Sal, some kind of a medicated shampoo. And I've been using that with limited success, but I can't remember what he called this condition. It was real common, he said.
Seborrheic dermatitis.
Oh, okay. And I'm trying to look for some other treatment that might be better than what I've been doing with the T-cell.
Is it on the top of your scalp or down near the back?
Oh, it's across the top.
Okay.
On the top.
Is it itchy?
Pardon?
Does it itch?
Sometimes, yes.
Okay.
I do. I did, for a while, I had a habit of itching it and scratching it, and that, of course, wasn't good, and I quit doing that as much as possible.
Okay. Yeah, there's some really great things that are over the counter. And what I find with this is I like to confuse it by using different things, so not just always, you know, T-cell or T-gel or something.
Uh-huh.
There's a Nizoral shampoo. It's a 1% medicated shampoo that deals with the yeast aspect of this,
mm-hmm.
and that one you can use a couple of times a week. Do you wash your hair like every day, every other day?
Every day.
Every day. Okay. Then I would use Nizoral 1% shampoo twice a week.
What is it again?
Nizoral, N-I-Z-O-R-A-L.
Okay.
1% shampoo.
Okay.
I would use one of the zinc pyrethrone shampoos. You know,
okay.
The zinc is another way to confuse it. And then the Head and Shoulders Intensive Care is actually wonderful. So I'd have all three of those in my shower, and I'd kind of mix and match them.
Oh, okay. So
if you had specific areas that were really bothering you, there are two things that are over the counter. One of them is called Scalpacin.
Oh, I think I tried that once.
Okay. It's a little liquid thing
uh-huh.
that you can use. And then there's a Scalpacin Plus.
Okay.
And I would go to the store, I'd buy those five things, and what you're going to find is that after you use those, you know, for maybe 2 weeks really faithfully,
mm-hmm.
that you're going to have to do something a couple times a week during the winter to, you know, so you'll have to, like, pull out your Nizoral a couple times. But most people can get it really pretty well cleared up with those things. one of the scalpacins has hydrocortisone in it, that same stuff that we were talking about in Cordate, and that can be a really helpful agent. So the scalpacin and the scalpacin plus, read them, because one of them has just salicylic acid in it and the other one has hydrocortisone in it. And you actually might want to have both of them because they're both really helpful agents.
Yeah, I don't remember which one I used. I think it was just plain scalpacin, but I'm not sure.
Okay. And then the other thing you could do is when you go to your regular doctor, you can ask for a prescription for something called Sinalar solution, S-Y-N-A-L-A-R.
Okay.
And that's a slightly stronger steroid that you can use for the redness and thickness.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Go to line number one. This is our next person, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Yes. I have a daughter who's an adolescent and was diagnosed with eczema about 2 years ago and has been treated. Lately, she's been complaining of joint pain in her knees and ankles and toes. Is this a disease that presents itself in that manner at all, or is this something else we should look into?
I would say that had she been diagnosed with psoriasis, we sometimes see that having joint, you know, problems. But no, if she's having joint pain, eczema is not tied in at all with that.
Okay.
Is she on anything for acne or anything?
No, she doesn't
okay.
have acne.
Yeah. No, I would get it looked into okay. in a different way.
Okay. Second question. Is super glue a recommended treatment for dry skin in the winter? The little cracks that come?
You know, I have actually found that the liquid Band-Aid is more effective.
Okay.
It's a newer substance. The super glue is really dicey because if you glue yourself to yourself with super glue, you need to be surgically removed.
Uh-huh.
I think that the liquid Band-Aid is a little safer to use and has been just as helpful.
Okay.
I actually had somebody who developed a really bad chemical reaction to the super glue, too. So
okay.
I've switched over most of my glue
users. Okay, I've not heard of that. I'll look for it. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just the other day, earlier in the week, we had our program that we do every month on women's health. We have an OBGYN who's here every month. And one of the questions we had was from a woman who was in the menopause and was having problems with acne. And I know that she's speaking for other women who have had this experience who felt that they'd left their acne behind, you know, finally after being a teenager and having problems, not particularly having problems. But then when they get into the perimenopause, they're getting around the time of their menopause, suddenly they're starting to have acne again, which I'm sure is very frustrating. And they think, look, I got enough aggravation. I don't need that. Is there anything that you can suggest, or what would you suggest for someone who now, for a woman who was, you know, maybe around 50, who hadn't had that problem, suddenly finds herself battling acne again?
It is so common that the pamphlet is called Acne at My Age? ? It's a huge problem, and seems to be very perimenopausal, which is a 17-year-long period, which means it can last for a long time. I have 70-year-olds who come in with new onset acne, and we call it rosacea or acne rosacea, and it seems to be an inflammatory process. So things that can actually make it worse, or that can make it better if you avoid them, are hot tea, hot coffee, hot tubs, hot showers, anything that increases the heat, which, of course, hot flashes do, right, can somehow cause an inflammatory process that leads to pimples and pustules. A lot of sun, a lot of alcohol, and a lot of spicy foods. Those are kind of the things we have people avoid if they start having a lot of usually redness with little pimples. The topical antibiotics can be quite helpful. There's one that topical metronidazole, which is metrocream, metrogel, metrolotion, Norotate. Those are all the substances that have topical metronidazole in them. Is probably my favorite prescription product. Over the counter, it's tough. You don't want to use scrubs. You don't want to be irritating. You want to be as mild in your treatment of your skin as you can. A lot of people find that same Cetaphil stuff that I was talking about with that other man. There's a Cetaphil liquid soap, which is very calming. Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes we need those dreaded antibiotics to get it under control, and it works great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's try and get it maybe one more caller at least, and that would be in Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
My question was exactly about acne. I'm a 32-year-old male, and I also suffer from, I guess, pimples, and so I'm not sure if that would be a diagnosis, acne, or what you would call that, but do you have any recommendations for that?
Well, it would be exactly what I just said. This would not be a hot flash issue, but it can come up with at any time. So those same things, avoiding hot tea, hot coffee, hot tubs, hot soup, hot spicy foods, sun, and alcohol are some of the things that can actually help with this. And then you actually need either the same antibiotics by mouth or the Metro Lotion, Metro Gel product. So, you know, either get into a dermatologist or probably your general doctor could go ahead and do that for you, but it's a common issue. And sometimes we even use Accutane in people who present with this much later acne if it's really severe and cystic.
I see. What was the name of that antibiotic that you mentioned?
It's a metronidazole. And if you just say Metro Gel, that'll work for you. Metrogel.
Okay, and that's something.
That's a one-time-a-day prescription. You can't get it over the counter, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, a prescription.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've also found that I think avoiding pop and I guess the type of fruit punches and things like that also seem to keep it down some.
Well, that's good. They also help with your waistline. So.
Yeah, certainly. All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, I'm sorry to say we have a couple of callers here we can't take, but we've just come to the end of the time. This is always a very popular topic on the program, so I guess we'll promise we'll try to do at least maybe in the summertime we'll do it. We may have to have one of our summer dermatologists in, but in any case, a few months down the road, we'll do it again. For right now, we want to say to our guest, Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She's a dermatologist, has practice in Urbana. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.